Chapter 47. The Soviets in Germany. While 27 Allied countries sent their delegates to swell the ranks of the treacherous squabblers at Versailles, Germany was sinking into chaos. Soviet commissars had established a reign of terror across Germany. Bavaria had been taken over by a bloodthirsty communist just out of jail. He was a Jew from Galicia who had turned professional agitator for the Soviets. His hair and beard were solid with grime because he never washed. His skin was waxy, like death, and he always wore an oily beanie which appeared fused to his skull. His name was Kurt Eisner. He was, wrote the French historian Benoist Mechin, one of those hybrid figures that history seems to produce during periods of chaos and political mayhem. History of the German Army, Volume 1, page 270. Paul Gentesen, the French author who witnessed the Bolshevik terror in Munich, said, Eisner was like an Oriental warlock. Eisner had been involved with the theater business and was adept in theatrics. He had somehow developed an attention-catching oratory, both strident and nebulous. On November 7, 1918, a meeting organized by the socialists massed more than 100,000 people to celebrate the revolutionary exploits in Kiel, Hamburg, and Lübeck. Nothing more than an outpouring of speeches was on the agenda. Eisner appeared suddenly, backed by a vociferous group. He was hoisted on the speaker's platform and burst out into violent tirades. The crowd, who had endured 4 years of hunger and suffering, responded to Eisner's rhetoric. He whipped them up into a frenzy and led them into the streets, with the help of trained professional agitators. Within hours, the Marxist-led mob had taken control of all government buildings, railway stations, post offices, and factories. Munich had fallen. It was an incredible event. While Germany was heroically holding out against the combined Allied and American onslaught, a Jew, and convicted criminal, from Galicia was sitting on the throne inside the royal palace of Bavaria. On the same evening of November 7, 1918, he declared a republic, and unleashed his commissars to mete out justice. Fearing for his life, King Ludwig III fled with his family, in the nick of time. Thus, one of the most Christian and traditional states in Germany had been overthrown in the course of a single night by an alien thug. Eisner appointed fellow Jews as ministers. A fanatical communist called Erich Muzum, the Jewish commissar of the Red Guards, declared Munich under the dictatorship of the proletariat. Eisner put him in charge of state security. The dictatorship's first act was to break diplomatic relations with Berlin. Eisner then proclaimed Germany's guilt in the war and proceeded to send the Allies documents establishing the culpability of the Reich. The so-called documents were out-and-out forgeries invented by Eisner and his cohorts. He then called on the Allies to accept his loyal oath and repentance. While Munich was reeling under the terror of the sudden coup, the Bavarian heartland had become horrified. Within a few days, Bavarians both in and outside Munich had composed themselves and begun to fight back against the invaders. A huge crowd assembled near the palace occupied by Eisner, to the cries of "Down with Eisner, demon of Israel! Down with Eisner, Judah's murderous clown! Eisner to the gallows! We want Bavarians to run Bavaria! Bavaria for the Bavarians!" Eisner dismissed the demonstration as the work of extremists and convened immediate elections to legitimize his coup. By then, the Bavarians had lost their fears of the armed commissars and voted massively against the Eisner regime. In a 180-seat Congress, 177 anti-Eisner congressmen were elected. Eisner dismissed the results. 6 days later, a lieutenant in the defeated German army shot him in the face, point blank. Muzum succeeded Eisner and called upon communist agitators from Augsburg, Fürth, Würzburg, and Lindau to rush to the rescue. Muzum was determined to impose communism ruthlessly by force of arms, against the wish of the overwhelming majority of Bavarians. The Marxist Republic poured out edicts: all previous laws are invalid, workers will work when they want. History is the enemy of civilization, and teaching it is forever abolished. The Commissar for Foreign Affairs sent a telegram to Pope Benedict XV complaining that the former Foreign Minister of Bavaria had fled to Bamberg after having stolen the keys of the ministry's bathrooms. He also informed the Pope that Berlin Minister Noske was a guerrilla, concluded the telegram, "We want eternal peace." Communications among fellow Marxist ministers were no more sane. The foreign minister informed the transport minister in another telegram, "My dear colleague, I have declared war against Württemberg and Switzerland because these pigs did not send me 60 locomotives. I am sure of victory. I know the Pope personally, and I'll get him to bless our arms." The era of the insane and the exalted was soon to be replaced by steely-eyed Marxist-Leninist bureaucrats. They had not been sprung out from jail or an insane asylum, but had been sent to Bavaria directly from Petrograd by Lenin's International. Lenin had set his mind to have direct control of Bavaria, which was just next door to Allied territories, his gateways to Western Europe. Lenin sent three of his most murderous commissars to take control of the Bavarian Red Army, the Jews Levin, and Axelrod, who had earned their stripes in mass terror under Bronstein Trotsky. They immediately decreed, "The days of ideology are over. We now have martial law. The firing squad is taking the place of speeches." Opponents and alleged opponents of the trio were rounded up and summarily shot to death. Whole massacres of hundreds of people at a time were common in the streets of Munich. While the murder of defenseless civilians was carried out in Bavaria, the delegates at the Paris Peace Conference had their first meeting. Far from being horrified at such massacres, the Allies could not contain their glee. The Bavarian bloodbath was a gift from the gods, which meant that Germany would be split and more Germans would be killed. Allied diplomatic envoys were rushed to Munich to kowtow to the bloodthirsty trio. They offered food and money to bolster their opposition to Berlin. Although the war had ended, Germany was still under Allied blockade, which was ruthlessly enforced. The first state of Germany to benefit from a lifting of the blockade would be communist-controlled Bavaria. Everywhere in Germany, Lenin's agents spread death and destruction. The Bolshevik agents would complete the Allied blockade by paralyzing international food supplies with sabotage and strikes. The Bolsheviks had closed down the Ruhr coal mines and people had little heat during the winter of 1918 to 1919. Thousands of children died of starvation. Lenin thought a starving people would provide good revolutionary recruits for the final communist assault on Berlin. Regiments from the German army reached Berlin on December 11, 1918. In accordance with his function as the new president of Germany, socialist Friedrich Ebert was at the Brandenburg Gate to greet them, "I salute you, you whom no enemy has beaten on the battlefield." These were the survivors who had left 2 million of their comrades on the battlefront. "Their features are drawn and their eyes reflect an awful exhaustion," wrote French historian Benoist Mechin. "They have polished their boots and belts, but it is like a funeral march. The old steel helmets are decorated with oak leaves. The Uhland cavalry musicians intoned, with Wagnerian splendor, Deutschland über alles." But the heroes knew, despite their day of recognition, that they were coming home to a country that had been torn apart by sabotage and revolutions. On November 9, 1918, the socialist leader Philipp Scheidemann had proclaimed Germany a republic. At the same time, he launched what he called the Republic of the Soviets. Scheidemann and the more radical elements in the Socialist Party decided to join the Marxist gangs who were beating up people in the streets and had occupied all of the city's newspaper offices. Many returned soldiers were set upon and viciously mugged, their medals and stripes were ripped off their uniforms. Wounded men were trampled to the ground and kicked by communist thugs who had never been at the front. Although Scheidemann admitted it was not a nice sight, he decided to form a coalition between moderate and extremist socialists, which was named the Council of the People's Commissars. Scheidemann would later explain, "The revolution was inevitable and it was necessary to lead it in order to avoid complete anarchy, the collapse," page 232. The Council of the People's Commissars consisted of three moderates, Ebert, Scheidemann and Landsberg, and three radicals, Hasse, Dittmann and Barth. On November 9, 1918, they were ensconced in Bismarck's former dining room at the Wilhelmstrasse. Scheidemann himself described how Berlin had fallen prey to Soviet mobocracy. Every morning, Karl Liebknecht gathered his troops in the siege sally. The focusing point was the statue of Emperor Otto the Lazy. The principle was to create constant disorder, to keep hell in motion, and above all fill the streets with the unemployed. I remember one Sunday evening in November. It was raining. Ebert and I were working with War Minister Schuch. We were told a crowd of demonstrators was approaching. We had the gates closed and all the lights in the front rooms switched off. The crowd was approaching in the dark with red flags and inflammatory placards. They screamed over and over, "Down with Ebert Scheidemann! Heil Liebknecht!" The Wilhelmplatz was getting filled with a huge crowd pressing against the gates. We stood still in an unlit room. Gradually things quieted down. Liebknecht climbed on top of a car and addressed the crowd with monotonous and repetitive slogans. He was drunk with his power and the number of people listening to him. He was giving vent to the worst incitements: the traitors are right in there, the Scheidemanns, the social patriots. We could storm their lair right now. This triggered a roar of approval. Then a band of highly excited soldiers forced their way into the council room. They said they were talking on behalf of Berlin's 30 garrison units. In the midst of tumult and screams, they shouted out their demands. It appeared later that these people did not represent anybody because none of the units mentioned had any knowledge of them. Liebknecht kept making speeches. Naturally, I was the recipient of the worst insults. They called me a traitor, an extremist, a lackey, a thief, a fraud. It was like sitting on dynamite. We worked day and night to the screams of demonstrators. We were besieged and hardly defended. As far as setting a foot in the streets, no one would even think of it. Meanwhile, a newly formed group called the Council of the Deserters was joining the communists. There was a lot of talk among the radical left about emulating our Russian comrades, who were the first to have flown the flag of freedom. Scheidemann, Collapse, page 254. The People's Commissars' Council had been given the press commissariat only to find out all the press rooms had been invaded by rioters who were indeed emulating their Soviet comrades. Scheidemann became very frightened at what was going on in the socialist communist government during November and December, 1918. The Reich, and Berlin in particular, was like a mental asylum. Scheidemann, Collapse, page 235. The asylum did contain many criminally insane individuals. Liebknecht and Luxemburg belonged in that category. They exploited the misery and panic of a people both out of work and starving, for their own fanatical purposes. The duo incited an extraordinary revolutionary ferment. They poured oil on the fire because it served their interests. Luxemburg feared the return of the soldiers from the front. They represented a disciplined force still led by patriotic officers. She was right. The soldiers who had fought 4 long years for their country's honor were shocked and sickened at the sight of the Marxist pandemonium confronting their eyes and ears. To neutralize any possible reaction, Liebknecht and Luxemburg ordered the Spartacists, as the communists in Germany called themselves at the time, to form 14 battalions with 1,000 men each. They would wear red armbands and would control the streets. Navy mutineers were organized in a division of the Volksmarine, which made the Imperial Palace their headquarters. They also occupied the Reichsbank and the Prussian Parliament. The third formation was the Sicherheitswache, the secret police in charge of all intelligence and the enforcement of the revolution. Liebknecht took control of the three armed groups. To control Congress, he created his own parliamentary police, the Republicanische Schutztruppe, which wore red and black armbands. Lenin had explained his plan succinctly: "We now see clearly how the revolution will progress. The Germans, the French, the British will do the work and socialism will triumph." Ebert was more the hostage than the ally of the Leninists. Spies tailed him everywhere. His correspondence was read or stolen and his telephone lines were tapped. Ebert finally realized he could be liquidated at any time. Although both Ebert and Skidmon were men of the left, they somehow remained patriotic. They felt now their only chance of survival was the army, or what was left of it after they had undermined it with their socialist-communist coalition. Ebert was kept isolated from everyone, but a telephone line almost saved him. Unknown to the Leninists, there was in Ebert's office a secret line linking, since 1914, the Chancery to the German High Command. Ebert managed to contact Marshal von Hindenburg in Kassel, at his headquarters in the historic castle where Napoleon's brother Jerome once reigned over Westphalia. The flimsy wire linking Berlin to Kassel would decide the fate of Berlin and Germany. The first contact was far from friendly. Hindenburg had little time for Ebert, whom he considered a frightened captive of the extremists. Although Ebert needed the army's help, he was fearful of a military dictatorship. He wanted to use the army to eliminate the extreme left, but not the moderate left. After asking for help, Ebert lost his nerve and cancelled his request. The Bolsheviks were not quite ready to grab total power. In the beginning of December, 1918, their militias were well armed but badly commanded. They needed another month to bring their troops to combat readiness. Hindenburg, on the other hand, was watching his troops fall apart. The men were tired and wanted to go home. Many did without authorization. As the barracks emptied, the communists moved in to seize weapons and equipment. Hindenburg knew if he wanted to act, he would have to move immediately. The Spartacists, wrote Benoist Mechin, felt they were gaining ground. A few more days and they would be the masters of Germany. Armee Allemande, Volume 1, page 82. The Spartacists sought mastery of Germany, but Lenin was their master. Skidmon, who had been playing both sides to save his skin, nevertheless would accuse his coalition partners of being on the payroll of Lenin. This was proven by the famous radio message of Soviet ambassador Joff in Germany. The message was a lengthy accounting of funds received by the communist Jew to provoke the revolution in Germany. It read, "Soldiers and sailors, keep your arms. Otherwise the capitalists will soon disperse you. Conquer the real power, gun in hand, and form a government of workers, soldiers and sailors with Liebknecht as leader." Thus a foreign power was already trying to impose its puppets on the German people. The Spartacists were becoming more insolent by the day. On December 16 they demanded that Hindenburg be fired. On December 17 they summoned the Soldiers' Council to a meeting and organized a vote decreeing, "The supreme command of the army and navy will be entrusted to people's commissars and to the Central Committee. All insignia of rank will be abolished. The soldiers themselves will designate their officers." Officers were discharged and disarmed and often set upon physically by Liebknecht's thugs. At his headquarters, Hindenburg was outraged. "I will never accept that the insignia I have worn since I joined the army be torn from my uniform. I do not accept this decision, which concerns the right of command among career officers. I recognize this decree as totally illegal, apart from usurping the decision-making process from the National Assembly." Ebert managed to convince his coalition partners to postpone their decrees until the January 19, 1919 legislative elections. He convinced them that the implementation of such measures could provoke a far stronger reaction than expected. In 2 months, Hindenburg had seen the frightened Ebert change his position at least 20 times. At the beginning of the war, Ebert had said, on August 4, 1914, "This is the most beautiful day in my life." Ebert switched issues and policies according to whomever he spoke with last. He was basically honest, but his essential lack of courage inclined him to manipulate and be manipulated. Hindenburg and his right-hand man, General Groener, no longer believed in him. To them, only the army could still stop communism. Like Julius Caesar, Hindenburg decided to cross the Rubicon, in this instance the Spree. On December 20, 1918, General Groener went to Berlin, accompanied by Major Schleicher, who would in 1932 be the last chancellor of the Weimar Republic. Schleicher was an intelligent soldier, but strong-willed and abrupt. Groener was a superb organizer who had just accomplished the flawless repatriation of all the German armies from the front. Without any real power to back them up except their courage, they went to confront the Revolutionary Council. Ebert, at least for the moment, was won over by the courageous soldiers. Lenin's agents became hysterical at the sight and ran to the streets screaming for the masses to arm themselves. The naval revolutionaries rushed to the chancery and cordoned off all accesses. Ebert was trapped like a rat. We were there without a single armed man to help us and without any means to oppose rampant thuggery, Ebert said. Ebert was lost. Once more he used his direct and secret telephone line to the high command. The government is imprisoned, he whispered, his mouth close to the receiver. You have always told me that if it ever came to that you would come to our help. The moment has come. The response from high command was swift, we will immediately march from Potsdam to free you. The situation was deteriorating rapidly in Berlin. The chief of police, Eichhorn, was on the payroll of Rasta, the Soviet information office. He had taken army headquarters with the help of armed navy deserters. He captured the commanding officer Wells and two of his assistants and had his Red Guards beat them up savagely. Eichhorn informed them they would be put to death if Ebert made the slightest move. The communists thought they had Berlin well in hand and relaxed their blockade of the chancery. Ebert breathed a sigh of relief and the eternal turncoat rushed to his secret telephone to ask Hindenburg to stop his troops marching any further. The marshal and I have reached the end of our patience, General Groener answered. You are destroying the morale of Germany's last loyal troops. Ebert had cried wolf so many times he had now lost all credibility, and the German army continued its march to Berlin. 3 months before, the German army had been 4 million men strong. On December 23, 1918, the German army, on its way to wrest Berlin from the Bolsheviks, was only a handful of loyal patriots, 800 in all. The deserters and mutineers under communist control manning Berlin's fortifications were supported by tens of thousands of armed Bolsheviks. General Otto Wells was held captive and was expected to be murdered at any moment. Weiss, wrote Scheidemann, was still held prisoner in a cellar below the castle's stables. Radke, the head of the sailors, announced in the evening he would no longer answer for Otto Wells' life. They were now trying to occupy the Vorwärts printing plant. We could not just abandon Wells. In the dawn of Christmas, 1918, the German troops bombarded the palace occupied by the Bolsheviks. A wall collapsed on them and the palace war stormed. At 9:30 in the morning the Bolsheviks were flying a white flag, ready to surrender. They asked to start capitulation talks. While the regular troops were talking, armed Bolsheviks encircled the palace. Suddenly, they attacked in consecutive human waves. It was a massacre. Only a few survivors managed to escape death and torture. Christmas night was horrible. Liebknecht and Luxemburg went on a rampage of killing, looking everywhere for German soldiers. Eichhorn had become the warlord of North Berlin. The socialists could no longer address the crowds. Their communist partners had seized their newspaper, Vorwärts, and occupied their press and editorial offices. A Vorwärts edition had been printed by another printer. It was seized by the rioters at gunpoint and all the newspapers thrown in the Spree River. Scheidemann, Collapse, page 260. The revolutionaries, wrote Benoist Mechin, are triumphing everywhere. The red flag flies over all the major buildings in Berlin. December 24, 1918 marks the highest phase of their power. From now on Berlin was totally under the control of the communist terrorists. At every street corner, Spartacists had placed machine gunners. The crackling of bullets and the explosion of grenades could be heard constantly. Then the shots subsided. A group of demonstrators were marching by waving placards and an officer's coat dripping with blood. Firing resumed after the demonstration had passed. The socialists were trapped. They could not leave the chancery for fear of being lynched. They could not communicate with anyone in the country because the post office, the railways and telegraph stations were now in the hands of the Red Councils. They could not even address the Berlin population because their newspapers and printing plants had been taken by storm. Benoist Mädchen, Armee Allemande, page 102. Liebknecht came to taunt the socialist ministers outside their closed windows, we could choke them in their den. The Rote Fahne newspaper, organ of the Spartacists, published in one of its street reports. The proletarians were massed elbow to elbow. Their multitude pushed as far as the Tiergarten. They had brought their arms, they waved their red flags, they were ready for anything. They waited at Alexanderplatz with guns, heavy and light machine guns. The sailors were guarding every passageway in Berlin. Public buildings were full of soldiers, sailors and workers. The highest authorities were now at the mercy of the revolutionaries. Scheidemann, Collapse, page 255.